So, I want to offer some dharma here, and I want to acknowledge for folks who haven't been here before, this particular one is quite sutta-based, kind of totally off a sutta. That Bonnie was joking the other day, sometimes I give talks about what I run across, and this is indeed one of those. I've been reading through there's a book of the four major Nikayas. There's one called The Numerical Discourses, which is pretty fascinating because it's all organized by sets of things. And I'm in the fours, which means every single sutta has four of something in it. And it's just the oddest darn way to organize something, but I kind of love it. But this one really caught me, and I kept thinking about it and decided it would be useful. You know, useful in terms of our journey. And it's about the bull elephant. And what's really interesting about, one of the many things interesting about the suttas, and I should turn the camera around, is how much the Buddha, it's a little bit like the Bible, how much the Buddha taps his life experiences and uses all kinds of metaphors around the circumstance in which he was to illustrate the Dharma. And a lot of that's about farming in all kinds of different ways, which he knew about. A lot of that's about the royal court, which he also knew about. And a lot of that's about the battlefield and various kinds of archery and different things of that nature to illustrate the path to Nibbana. And, you know, one takeaway from that is some of the stuff is so visceral that you it's clear he really knew about what he was talking about. And some of it's so odd sometimes that you almost couldn't be making it up. And so I think what's useful about this stuff is here 2,600 years later, we can really see how the obstacles that we face as practitioners and how we get through them aren't categorically different from what he faced. And differences are time, you know, and karma and stuff, but there's real messages in there that are helpful. But still, it might seem odd to get spiritual inspiration in the characteristics of what's called the king's bull elephant. That's the phrase he used, the king's bull elephant. So this would be in my understanding of warfare at that time, there was cavalry, there was soldiers, but there were giant male elephants that were leading the charger, kind of like the M1 tanks of 2,600 years ago. And they were pretty formidable. And so this was a significant part of the landscape of conflicts. And so speaking to a group of monastics, this is in the fours, it's 1141, if anyone's looking for this sutta, 1141. Speaking to a group of monastics, the Buddha said, a bull elephant displays four factors that are worthy of a king, and then he explains how these four are also worthy of a practitioner, a monastic in this case, but it really extrapolates to us. He said, here a king's bull elephant is one who listens, who destroys, who patiently endures, and who goes. So we're going to go through each of the four from the point of view of the bull elephant, and then what he says about monastics, and expand a little bit about what it might mean to us. So, one is the elephant, the one who listens. And about the elephant, he says, and how bhikkhus, how monastics, is a king's bull elephant one who listens? Here, whatever task the elephant trainer sets for it, whether or not it has ever done it before, the king's bull elephant heeds it, attends to it, directs his whole mind to it, and listens with eager ears. It is in this way that a king's bull elephant is one who listens. And when you think about it, I mean, elephants are, as we all know, very smart. And if they knew the position they were in, leading an army, they would listen because it's important for success and also, in that case, to not die. So these are kind of urgent matters that this elephant is being trained for. In the case of monastics, the way that the Buddha extended it is kind of easy to anticipate. He says here, When the Dhamma and the discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata, referring to himself, is being taught, a bhikkhu heeds it, attends to it, directs his whole mind to it, and listens with eager ears. It is in this way that a bhikkhu is one who listens. So if you think about what he's saying, it gets pretty deep because, you know, we hear teachings and we read teachings. We hear teachings on ethics, on wholesome mind, on kindness, but how much do we heed them? How much do we really listen to them with our hearts and change our mind as we would if we were a bull elephant about to go into battle with our survival depending on those instructions? You know, you really take it in a certain way and it's like, oh, this is important. Do we direct our whole mind to it? Because the elephant, you know, for one thing, they need to survive. For another thing, they're trying to win the battle. And there's not, just in a certain way, there's no room for error. It's a big deal, a big momentous clash. And, you know, here in our lives, I mean, there's no way around it. We're pretty comfortable. We've got roofs over our heads. I know everyone here does. And some kind of livelihood. You're able to eat. You're able to stay dry. No one's shooting at you. No one's going to arrest you because of something you might say. We're not in a war zone. It's pretty amazing how comfortable this is. And from a Dharma point of view, that can be really beguiling. You know, we can kind of just cruise with that. But as we know, sickness, old age, and death are inevitable and not to be ignored, which is why the Buddha taught us what he taught us. And some of you know, back at the end of August, I was 4 days at this NDE conference, a near-death experience conference, which I think the talk is now going to go up on the SIMS website if you wanted to hear it. But there were a lot of things that it was, I got to say, I'm really glad I went. I had this feeling it was really going to change my view, and it did in a lot of ways. And I was around people who had died for 4 days, and they had little green tags, experiencer, people who had NDEs. Not everybody there had, but many of them had. And you could talk to people. Some of them had pretty horrific deaths, car wrecks, driving into guardrails, overdoses, all kinds of stuff. And then due to some, well, on the one level, miracle of modern medicine, but on another level, most cases, they knew they had to come back. They were, you know, up there looking down at the ambulance and saying, I don't want to go back. And they said, well, and this guy would say, well, actually, you have work to do. In fact, it was one amazing, as an aside, I listened to one that I didn't hear because they just put the entire conferences up on the web for people who were there. So you can listen to all the talks due to the aforementioned wonders of the internet. And there was one woman who was, oh my God, she was amazing. She was her parents had both been addicts. So that's all she knew when she grew up. That just seemed normal. You know, if you feel stressed out, you take drugs and it's okay. But then they finally hit bottom and they both committed suicide together. Suddenly at 21, her parents had just committed suicide. And she was a total addict herself at that point, and a prostitute and stealing stuff, and just life was completely out of control. Which is why she died on the floor of this bathroom, which is why she suddenly found herself up there after she died. And her guide said, and it was like amazing. He said, oh my God, there's love in the universe. I don't believe it. And the guide said, well, you got to go back. You have work to do. And she said, I don't want to go back. I don't want that, not that, not that thing down there, that dead body on the floor. And then he said, and then they literally, they had this back and forth. And they said, okay, there's one alternative. And she said, what's that? He said, you can incarnate in this baby. And they showed her this baby about to be born. And then they gave her a scan of the life conditions that she'd be born into. And she went, oh, I guess I'll go back. Because I don't know what it was, but it wasn't good. So she had the same, she would have to learn the same lesson anyway. A little bit of an aside. But it does, it really, for me, it dialed up the sense of how close it is. Because most of those people didn't expect to die. It wasn't like they were old and then they died and their arc, and it sort of made sense. It was like they absolutely didn't expect to. Car wrecks, all those things, didn't expect to. So we need to prepare as if we will. So this is the question about the first of the four. You know, how much do we take the Dharma in? How much do we really have it turn our hearts and minds? The first of the four instructions to the bull elephant and to the bhikkhus. And one thing I've found is that in terms of this question about how much we pay attention, whenever we have the opportunity to be around a highly awakened being, it really shifts things. It becomes, oh, that's really obvious. You know, you'd be around the Dalai Lama or something, it's like everything's different. And all the stuff that we might get distracted by just doesn't matter anymore. And you see, you can feel the potential for awakening. But most of us, you know, I mean, all of us, to some degree, we're like distractible children, and we kind of get our attention to the, you know, the colorful tinsel of life, right? All of the entertainments and adult toys like cars and boats, all that stuff. And we let the teachings kind of roll off us a little bit. I mean, it's interesting in our dharmic circumstance here and that we now have, you know, Clear Mountain Monastery with these two monastics who have shed everything to focus on the Dharma. It's pretty amazing to be around those guys and see what that means. And it doesn't mean we have to be monastics, but you can really, it dials up what's needed to transform the view. And you can see it demonstrated in how those guys express the Dharma that something's changing. So in our reality of life and death and the shortness of life and the possibility of awakening, the word tusker, they use tusker a lot in this for a large male elephant in the suttas also. And we're kind of like a tusker staring at a battle, except we're sort of not aware we are to some degree. And by the way, as some of you, I just said in there, I'm on October 14th, unless I don't go, I am going to Thailand. I say that because I canceled twice, 2 days before, due to various... My wife was sick the second time, and we bought a new house, and she didn't want me to go the first time. So, but if those things don't happen, I'll be going to Thailand on the 14th, and partly just to be around some highly awakened beings in three different wats in Thailand, and just to, you know, kind of dial up my own sense of how to use the time available. So, kind of what the Buddha is saying is when we are exposed to the Dharma or the truth, whether oral teaching or reading or whatever way the Dharma comes through, really bring our heart and mind to it. You know, and even if we don't like the teacher, even if the word's obscure, just keep seeing what we see. Stretch ourselves, you know, stretch ourselves. Because it's important. And I'm not trying to be like super Buddhist. I mean, you know, some of you know I did a week-long retreat at a Trappist monastery outside of Portland early this year. And they were amazing monastics there. I got connected with one of them. He was so great. We were just heart to heart. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Very same sense of fierce focus and same sense of knowing life and death. And there was a whole line of crosses on the back where monastics had died there. I mean, you know, crosses this high. There's like a graveyard behind the back. It's pretty interesting. So the way to bring the teachings alive is to direct our heart and minds to it with eager ears. And next is the second, and in some ways the most powerful part of these four instructions is the one who destroys. And don't worry, it'll be different than what you think. But the Buddha said, here, when a king's bull elephant has entered the battle, it destroys elephant and elephant riders. It destroys horses and cavalry. It destroys chariots and charioteers. It destroys infantry. It is in this way that a king's bull elephant is one who destroys. Now, of course, in the Dharma, we're not talking about killing anybody or violence in that way. So this is not what that's about. But what is it that needs to be destroyed? Why do they use that metaphor? What do we learn from that? And it turns out the answer, as much as the thing we just talked about, is our distraction and our attachment to things that bring suffering and dukkha. So what's the point? We need to see through those. And this kind of idea of destroying them is pretty powerful. but it's a way to brighten up the heart, he says, the Buddha says. And how is a bhikkhu one who destroys? Here a bhikkhu does not tolerate an arisen sensual thought, but abandons it, dispels it, terminates it, and obliterates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will, an arisen thought of harming, any other bad, unwholesome states that arise from time to time, but abandons them, dispels them, terminates them, and obliterates them. It is in this way that a bhikkhu is one who destroys. And this is, in a lot of ways, I found this one of the most powerful articulations of the importance of cultivating wholesome thoughts and abandoning unwholesome ones in the, I don't know, it really struck me anyway, in the Pali Canon. It's really amazing. And there's some key points here because it's not personal. He just talks about thoughts that arise. If there's no personal identification there, they just, oh, this arose. What do you do? There's no blame. There's no negative. Just, it arises. What do you do? And it's interesting. He's not talking about actions. He's just talking about thoughts, which is pretty powerful because, you know, we have the five precepts to refrain from unwholesome actions, to not kill, to not lie, to not steal, to not do sexual misconduct, and then not abuse or do intoxicants, depending on how you interpret it. But those are actions. So we can do all that stuff, do the five impeccably, but then what's going on in our hearts and minds? What are we floating around in, and how are we dealing with what arises, is what he's pointing to. So it's subtle. He's just talking about wholesome thoughts or unwholesome thoughts, and what do we do? Because sometimes, I know all of, I mean me, and I'm sure all of us, sometimes we just kind of let thoughts just kind of run on, and we kind of do it quietly so no one else can see, you know? But we're doing all this stuff inside. And Buddha's saying how important that is. And there's some really funny stories, you know, in the Dharma about, and also not, also with like Neem Karoli Baba, Baba Ram Dass's teacher, who was totally telepathic, and like, you know, he'd totally tell him what he was thinking, and then Ram Dass would say, oh my God, all the stuff I've been thinking that he didn't know I was thinking. So it's an important arena because what we think, you know, the thoughts that float through us and the degree to which, how we handle that, that's so important. It has everything to do with the way we create our sense of self and then what we do with that and where it takes us because, you know, we can't awaken if our mind's all cluttered with stuff and if we're just kind of like feeding the beast without being mindful of what it is. And you know, in our difficulties with meditation, that's all in the realm of thoughts pretty much. It's not like, I mean, you know, we may have a sore body, but most of the time, it's our minds and our hearts that knock us off the rail and distract us and all of that. And then the sequencing, you know, sometimes when you read the suttas, and it's easy to breeze by. It's one of the things being in this role is really interesting because sometimes when I suddenly realize, oh my God, this is way more subtle than I got the first time. Because the sequencing from the easy to the difficult is baked right into here and sort of gives us a roadmap. No judgment, but he says, the first step, he says, just to abandon it, just to let go of thinking that thought. If that's easy, abandon's easy. That's, you know, that's the first thing he says to do. Just stop doing it. And sometimes that's all we need to do, just to recognize it. Oh, and we can just let it go. Sometimes it's just that easy because thoughts just get sparked out of our karma, our predilections, and you just sort of see, oh, that silly thing, and just let it go and abandon it. It's really easy sometimes. But if that doesn't work, then the next step is a little more active, but still kind of a light touch to dispel the thought. It's a little more active, kind of like a sense of dispelling, you know, a mist or something. But it's, so we're not just abandoning, got a little bit of energy into it, but it's still kind of light. Like the sun dispels fog. But it's handy to have that kind of internal vocabulary so we can work with what comes up. But sometimes that doesn't work. And then the next step the Buddha's talking about is to terminate the thought. You know, put some energy into stopping it, a little bit more fierceness, a little bit more power. Just, I'm going to stop thinking that. I don't want to be in that unwholesome state, so you just terminate it. But what about those ones that really kind of torment us and obsess us? I mean, I don't know, you know, something that's just a repeating pattern. Then he says, just as the bull elephant would obliterate an enemy, we need to do that. So, you know, I have this image of this elephant. That's why it's so powerful. You go back to the elephant, just imagine this situation of a battle and how violent that is and how powerful that is. But the Buddha's kind of saying sometimes we need to be that kind of powerful with ourselves to work with what's going on inside, because time is short and death is uncertain and the potential for awakening is there. So just kind of like a battlefield. And then the third one is just the conditions for a bull elephant, the conditions of battle, just how uncomfortable that might be. But, you know, the conditions of life can be really uncomfortable, as we all know. I mean, I know some of you pretty well, and you've been through some wretched stuff. I get that. So how do we work with that, you know? And maybe this is helpful, because despite how difficult the issues we've been through, it's probably not exactly the same as being in an adult battlefield with people trying to kill you. It's sort of okay, I can feel good about that. No one's actually trying to kill me in a battlefield. So describing that situation, the Buddha says, here, when a king's bull elephant has entered the battle, it patiently endures being struck by spears, swords, arrows, and axes. It endures the thundering of drums, kettle drums, conches, and tom-toms. It is in this way that a king's bull elephant is one who patiently endures. That's just so graphic, you know. I mean, because the Buddha, you know, growing up in royalty, he was trained as a young man to do all this stuff. He was a very good, marksman with a bow and arrow, and he knew how to do this stuff. So maybe he actually was in battles. I don't know. But he knows about it. And you can see how an elephant would be just a target. You know, if it's the M1 tank, it would be the target. Everybody's trying to stop it. It must be just terrible to be an elephant in that situation. So there's this whole part of it. It's all about being attacked and all that visceral stuff. And the other one's about noise. And I feel like there's sort of a metaphor there for our lives, you know? You feel stuff coming at us, and then just the noise. And by the way, the conch thing, for those of you who don't know, in Tibetan, well, in many places in Asia, Tibetan practice in particular, they cut the end off a conch and make a horn out of it. So that's what he's referring to there, and they're very loud. The thundering of drums, kettle drums, conches, and tom-toms. It must have been just amazing. So we're not going to be in that situation. We're not bull elephants. We're not going to be in battles, hopefully. Probably not. But the discomforts of life can be really difficult. And the Buddha said, here a bhikkhu patiently endures cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind, the burning sun, and serpents, rude and offensive ways of speech. He's able to bear up with arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, harrowing, disagreeable, sapping one's vitality. So that's kind of amazing, you know, because you think of the time of the Buddha and all these monastics, and I don't know about you, but I can kind of get this, oh, it must have been so nice, and you see these kind of like New Agey pictures where it's all kind of pink with little stuff floating around, but that was hard. He's just saying being a monastic then was hard. Not so hard now, but, you know, all these monastics that we know, a lot of them go on Tudong, where they go wandering. Both these monastics have. I don't know, they just take off with nothing other than their bowl, three robes, a water filter, and an umbrella. They just take off, and if food is offered, they eat, and if it isn't, they don't, and if it rains, they get wet, and like that. So it's pretty amazing, and it's kind of like that. So we can learn from that in terms of our own determination to maintain our direction, because we don't have quite those situations, but we do have, I bet, rude and offensive speech? Has anyone ever had rude and offensive speech directed at them? Yeah. There you go. See some nods. So there's that. And then, you know, there's three things in here. And the last is this description of physical pain. Painful, racking, sharp, piercing, harrowing, disagreeable, which is a kind of a stock phrase that comes up in the suttas here and there when the Buddha himself is experiencing pain. That's always how it's used. It's the first time I've seen it, actually, maybe I'm wrong, with other monastics, but in terms of himself, there's a number of places, like when Devadatta tries to kill him and rolls a boulder over him, rolls a boulder and the boulder misses, but he ends up with a stone splinter in his foot. And he has all those descriptions of pain. Except for sapping one's vitality. That didn't seem to happen with the Buddha. But maybe with us it does. And, you know, I got to say, this really hit a chord for me, because going to Thailand, I'm sure it's going to be really uncomfortable. I mean, I've been there before, and it's just, I'll be in a complete Thai circumstance. So, you know, it's not set up for Westerners, basically, or kind of, I don't know. Anyway, it'll be uncomfortable. And so I'm kind of like trying to, you know, I can see myself kind of, I don't really want to do that, but kind of preparing myself, because there's something to learn. But there really is something to learn, because, you know, we get knocked back by all kinds of things. And to really just like, okay, accept it, like he's saying, just accept it and have patience. And the bull elephant is just an extreme case of being absolutely attacked in every possible way. But we have our own difficulties. And to kind of almost to have that example help us continue and not just kind of get discouraged or knocked back or slowed down or stopped, because things are hard. And then the last of the four is this kind of puzzling idea in the language that the king's bull elephant is one who goes. What's that? The one who goes. You look at the description, you just kind of see how this fourth is linked to the third. Because the patience is about bearing up in difficulty. The fourth is about moving forward despite fear. Just moving forward continually despite fear, trepidation. Buddha said, here the king's bull elephant quickly goes to whatever region the elephant trainer sends it, whether or not it has ever gone there before. It is in this way that a king's bull elephant is one who goes. So all three are here. You know, this elephant's listening that it needs to go somewhere. It destroys fear that it might stop it, and it continues despite painful hardships, and it goes where it's never been before. This kind of brave stretching. No elephant has been before. You know, it's like, my God, that's a Star Trek reference. You can all laugh. But, you know, that's part of the bravery there, you know, because that's sort of what the path is. We're going where we have not been before. Even the Buddha, when he awakened, he said, I awakened to that which I never knew before, has not been seen before. And the Buddha said, here a bhikkhu quickly goes to that region where he has never before gone in this long stretch of time. That is, to the stilling of all activities, the stilling of all activities, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. It is in this way that a bhikkhu is one to goes. And this is really interesting, because he's describing in this incredibly succinct way the crux of the whole path. It's right there, the whole thing. And it shows where this is heading. He's talking to these bhikkhus, and he's showing that just to be able to embrace these difficult situations and keep going where they haven't gone yet takes you to nibbana. That's where where patience becomes sacred, and this opens this door. And you look at this little list, just boom, boom, boom. It's really interesting. Stilling of all activities. I mean, I don't think that means doing nothing, because the elephant's very active, but it doesn't mean stilling of activities that lead to distraction, that lead to suffering, and activities of the mind he was talking about, the unwholesome thoughts, to just really start to not be swept up in that. And then relinquishment of all acquisitions. It's very interesting now to monk, to be sure. They don't have any acquisitions except for the robe and the bowl. But for us, we got stuff, but we can still relinquish it. It's kind of like, what is it? Not layaway, but it's kind of like borrowing, you know? It's kind of like borrowing, you know, because, I mean, even if you have a Lamborghini, you know, you're going to die, it'll still be there. Or, you know, these silly things you read, someone buys their Lamborghini and then cranks it up going out of the dealer and wrecks it the next minute. These things happen all the time. So there's nothing that's sticky. You know, we drive a car we paid for, we live in a house with a mortgage, we even, you know, have a partner or something, a spouse that we love, and at the same time, it's all changing. And we can't hold on to it. They're not acquisitions. There's no permanence there. We have to relinquish them. And the more we can, you know, treasure, and especially in terms of a spouse, that person then also realizes that there's change. And he says, from this comes destruction of craving, second noble truth, which drives the whole wheel of samsara. So he's taking us, this is taking us where we've never gone before, unless, you know, maybe there's a Buddha here. But in case there isn't, then it's somewhere we haven't gone before. And what's interesting about this, in this whole thing, there's not a single mention of meditation or mindfulness or anything. It's a whole different channel, a whole different understanding of what the path is, just to not be stuck and to keep letting go. And then almost at the end here, the sutta kind of ends with this trifecta of Dharma terms, dispassion, cessation, and nibbana. It's almost the same as in the last tetrad of the 16 steps. I think that ends with equanimity, if I remember right. Or maybe I don't. But, you know, dispassion is just that sense of not adhering, not being passionate about things, letting go, and cessation is dropping. And nibbana is waking up, and then we're free. Able to choose what's ahead in terms of how we are with whatever is ahead. So let's pause for a moment here.